Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and I have the dream gift for your health-conscious pals. Wrap up a sack of potatoes and an electric shocker. And no, I am not crazy. This is cutting-edge science. It comes from a Japanese researcher who's given his life to beating up vegetables. He found the electrified potato is a healthier potato. Apparently, with a good shocking, the spud produces more antioxidants. Now, that same researcher zapped other vegetables, and they, too, made more good compounds. So, should we be buying beat-up vegetables instead of the pristine ones? And if stressed-out veggies are healthier, why aren't stressed-out people? Well, stay with us for more of life's big questions this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today we've gift ideas to build on or just lust over, like the great sweets of Mexico, barely known here and beautifully exotic. A master jam maker coaches us in homemade jams, and for a refreshing break from the action, the Stearns have yet another pork discovery. And of course, there is that woman of so many talents, Amy Sedaris. When last we checked in with actor, writer, and comedian Amy Sedaris, she had revealed to the world her own unique approach to entertaining. Well, single-handedly, Amy brought back the retro cheese ball, and she conjured up the best idea I've heard for nosy guests. Fill your medicine cabinet with marbles. Well, gift season is here, and Amy is once again rising to the occasion. She's written the book Simple Times, Crafting for Poor People. Amy, it is so good to have you back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You had to have had the most fun doing this book.
I did have the most fun doing this book. It was a riot, and it was ambitious. We did a lot in very little time. Again, we shot it all in my apartment, and I fed people. I had a crock pot going 24 hours a day full of canned chicken soup with a stack of white saltine crackers next to it.
You are so true to your traditions. I love this. Have you always crafted?
I have. Well, and I still make the same things I made when I was five, when I was in Girl Scouts. Nothing's changed. I'm very limited, but I know who can craft well, and I know where to find them, and I know what I want. And the things in the book that I made, it's pretty obvious. They're the ones falling apart.
What are some of your favorite culinary crafts?
Let's see. Well, there's a salt igloo in the book. It's beautiful. A friend of mine made it. I just think it's lovely. And that's something that you could put out if you're cooking, you know, to have that around in your kitchen or on a table display. It'll get a lot of attention. So I like that.
And do you chip at it to season, or do you leave it solely as a centerpiece?
Oh, I didn't think about chipping at it. I would say I'd leave it out. It's just, it could be seasonal. And then you could put it away and bring it back out. It's not going to go away.
Well, that's true. It's salt. It doesn't really go anywhere.
Right.
What else?
This time what I did in the craft book is I made a lot of food and used it to put around the craft project. So let's say I'd make this huge cake, a drumstick cake, which is just like a white cake, and I use those peppermint sticks, mm-hmm. so it looked like a drum. And then I might put that in the background and just say, oh, it's about a knitted cap with bangs attached to it. So I used food to put next to the crafts this time. So the food, it looked like it was being the scene stealer, but it was really behind the scenes.
You also make wool sausages, don't you?
Yeah, a friend of mine knitted some sausages. I wanted a whole chapter on sausage making because originally I wanted to make a wig out of real sausages, sausage links. I thought it'd be funny. But instead I ended up building a log cabin out of the sausage links. And there's a chef from a restaurant in New York, and he gave me all the sausage recipes except for the sausage cookie, which I had at a wedding when I was in the mountains in North Carolina. I swear to God, it was like a chocolate chip cookie, but without the chocolate chips. Instead, they used sausage.
I don't think there's really anything wrong with that. That makes perfect sense.
They were good
to me
at the time, top of a mountain. It's just what I wanted to eat.
I can imagine.
But then I found this girl, and she knitted those sausages, and they're beautiful.
They also are going to last longer than the sausages.
Yeah, they're going to last longer. And you can put them around your neck, you know, like a neck brace, the chorizo neck warmer. And then I have hot dogs on a rake where you're, you know, it's a poor man's hot dog roasting thing. I'd take a big rake and I would force hot dogs onto them and stick them in my fireplace. Nasty, but it worked.
And you can also feed a crowd that way. You don't have to do them one at a time.
Right. Fun. Yay! Kids' parties. Do it again. Do it again.
And you did a whole chapter on confectionery.
Yes, I wanted to have a sweet chapter because I was doing a movie with Neil Patrick Harris, and his mother sent him these ooey-gooey bars or something, and they were just fantastic. So that's where I got the idea to do a whole chapter and just ask people, you know, their mothers if they had any old recipes. And then I just filled the chapter with recipes from mothers. Except there's a clubhouse cookie that involves marijuana. Keeping it green, keeping it green. That's a great recipe. All organic. It's really good. You need that if you're going to do a craft book. Trust me.
I understand. I'm also wondering how long we're going to be on the air after this interview. But we're just going to let that go.
Okay.
So what homemade gifts are you making this year?
Well, the only thing that I make to give away are those pot holders where you buy the plastic loom and you use those cotton loops. And I know people have been making those since, you know, when they were 5 years old, but I didn't discover that kit till I was in my early 40s. And I can make those pot holders, and I make them very well, and I sell them. I've already sold out, but I usually sell them on the book tour. So that's what I'll give out. But normally I don't like to give away crafts because nobody wants it. It's just crap nobody wants. Nobody wants it. There's a great fudge recipe in the book. You know, giving food for presents, a really nice idea, I think. A coffee cake. I mean, I'm for giving food away, but crafting, no. It's just going to end up in the garbage.
I don't know. That's awfully sad, isn't it?
Well, unless you're a really good crafter. I mean, and if you're a really good crafter, you're going to sell those things. You're not really going to give them away.
Amy, as always, it is a total joy, and you have a great holiday.
You have a nice holiday.
Amy Sedaris is co-creator of Simple Times, Crafting for Poor People. Now, you can find that recipe for ooey gooey bars as well as excerpts from her very, very funny book on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our entire collection of recipes, our podcasts, gift ideas, and get registered for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all there, splendidtable.org. I was reading an article by historian Laura Shapiro about how bad the food was in the White House of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. The given then in Washington was that if you were invited for dinner, eat before you go. What they needed back then was Jane and Michael Stern. Now, they do the Road Food site and report on good food all across the country. And they come in and tell us about their finds. So guys, where have you been supping?
We have been supping in Fall River, Massachusetts, of all places.
Home of Lizzie Borden.
Home of Lizzie Borden. But more important than the 40 wax with the axe is Hartley's Pork Pies. This is a bakery that has been around for over 100 years. And you wonder, pork pies in Fall River, Massachusetts? How did that happen?
Yeah.
It happened because, you know, Fall River, Massachusetts, 100 years ago, was a thriving mill town. And a lot of the people who came to work in the mills were from the British Isles. And as you know, pork pies are big over there.
That makes sense. You know, it occurs to me, I don't think Americans, really understand this idea of the pie that's made, you know, with meat. It's, in other words, not, it's not sweet, a savory pie.
Absolutely. I think there's been a little bit of a resurgence of chicken pot pie.
As comfort food.
As comfort food. Pork pies, I think if you say pork pie to somebody, they think of the hat that the guys wear in Mad Men on TV. They don't think of something you eat.
Well, what are the pork pies like in this place?
Well, you get two sizes. There is a family-sized pork pie that will feed up to 9, or an individual one, which, when you get it, looks too small because it's hardly bigger than a medium-sized cupcake. But inside of it is just, like, dense with, like, delicious seasoned roasted pork and just enough gravy so it's all moist, but not so much that you can't just, like, split it open by hand and eat it. The crust, I have to say, makes all the difference in the world with any kind of pie, but especially a savory pie. When that savory pie is surrounded by a true lard crust.
I hope that you were going there. I really
yes. I mean, as you know, Lynn, it literally, and I'm not speaking for it, literally melts in your mouth. And that melting lard crust surrounding the seasoned pork inside is one of the, it's just an unbelievably delicious sensation.
You know, Michael, I just had a little culinary light bulb over the head. Hartley's is in Fall River, Massachusetts.
That
is correct. And pork pies, as you just said, don't have a lot of gravy inside. Think of the traditional chicken pot pie of Connecticut, how that is a little dense cupcake looking thing also with just a ton of chicken inside, and the gravy is served on the side. So maybe gravyless pot pies really are New England.
They may be on the same family tree indeed.
Interesting. But the flavor, I mean, is this sort of like eating a warm pate? Is it that kind of rich?
Not that homogenized.
It's more of a hash than you would expect in a pate. It's maybe not quite as rich. I mean, because it's the kind of thing that when you eat one, you want another. Whereas if I have a serving of pate, I think, oh my gosh, that's enough for now.
Yeah.
But these are like, they're very hearty and very rich, but not overly rich the way a pate might be. And the other thing I have to say, I mean, what's great about this place is, as I said, it's a bakery. And a lot of people come in, take a pork pie and eat it outside or in their car. They also make, and you can buy it by the slice, chorizo pizza.
Ooh.
Which is another Rhode Island.
Which, as you know, chorizo is the Portuguese sausage.
Yeah,
so, I mean, talk about cross-cultural. You know, an English-ancestored bakery that's making an Italian dish with Portuguese sausage on it.
And this sounds so...
That's all American.
Well, it is, but that area has a lot of Portuguese immigrants.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And around the corner, in fact, you can go to a bakery and get a malasada, you know, which is one of those, like, fried breads topped with sugar and cinnamon. Yum.
Well, that'll be dessert after I have the pork pie, because I'm picturing the pork pie as a little, like, handheld dinner.
That's my kind of meal, bread followed with bread.
You got it. Exactly. That's my thought. And
the
fat.
Perfect meal.
Thank you, too.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Jana Michael Stern's latest contribution to dining literature is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can find their latest dining picks on the website, splendidtable.org.
Pumpkin squash, oh my gosh, too much cake, belly ache, who's the boss?
Well, brace yourself for the December overkill, where the sight of one more plate of rich food is going to send you over the top. Well, I've got retaliation for you in the form of a recipe. It's light, fast, and fresh. Now, I'm talking about pho. This is the Vietnamese rice noodle soup with beef and fresh herbs. Now, I've really streamlined this recipe, but you get all that light, intense-tasting broth that's made with garlic, that's toasted with onion and spices. And at the last minute, you just drop in a minuscule amount of beef and a handful of noodles. And the best part is the Vietnamese table salad. For the soup, you use it as the final flavorings. There's piles of lettuce and fresh herbs and chilies and lime wedges on a plate. And everybody takes what they want to season their own soup. So find the recipe, Vietnamese rice noodle soup with beef and fresh herbs, on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with the unusual sweets of Mexico and exceptional jam from winter fruits. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is the baking season. We turn out more cookies and sweets now than at any other time. But stop for a moment and imagine these sweets. Glistening little candied limes stuffed with fresh coconut. Oh, individual pumpkin seed nougats sitting on little squares of banana leaves. Cinnamon orange candy with pinto beans that taste like sweet chestnuts. Honey-spiced Arab candies. Well, unless you're lucky enough to be born in a Mexican family or live in the right neighborhood, this is the Mexican food we have not seen. Pastry chef Fanny Gerson is pulling back the curtain with her book, My Sweet Mexico, Recipes for Authentic Pastries, Breads, Candies, Beverages, and Frozen Treats. Fanny, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Fanny, I'm leafing through this book. It makes me crazy. because these sweets do not look like anything that we're familiar with. There's a vividness to them.
Well, I think that, you know, just like the culture, they're very colorful in every way, not just visually, but culturally. You know, there is a very strong family tradition of making sweets, and every region has their specialty. Every family has their special recipe. And I think one of the most interesting aspects is that they all have a very strong historical background. And many people may not realize, but there are a lot of parallels between Arab cuisine and Mexican cuisine because they occupied Spain for many centuries. So when the Spaniards came to Mexico, they brought, their recipes and their influence. And because the climate in Mexico lent itself to replicate a lot of these recipes, but then they found that they had all these new ingredients. So they brought with them, you know, sugar and dairy, but then they found mango and limes and chilies. And so it's kind of the cultural blend coming together that makes it so wonderful. And the array is just outstanding.
You know, I'm just looking, though, at this. The sweetness seems incredibly intense. The flavorings seem incredibly intense. You know, I'm looking at, what is it, a candied sweet potato candies and milk fudge and coffee-flavored corn cakes or corn cookies. I mean, these sound so powerful. Am I getting carried away
yes.
here?
No. I think you're right on. In Mexico, there are a few things that are subtle. You know, we like, full forward, flavors
right.
and colors and everything. And so these sweets, you know, there's a big tradition of sweets, but not necessarily of desserts. You know, we don't have, you know, the traditional pie or things like that
right.
you have at the end of the meal. You rather have a selection of sweets that you have at the end of a meal. And you save those cake-like desserts for special occasions. And so because we have all these sweets, they tend to be kind of small and very intensely flavored and, you know, very sweet, you know, where you're just supposed to have a few. And it's almost like a sensual aspect to them, I think.
That's, I think, what comes across is the sensuality.
And I do have to say that that most of the these kinds of confections is not something that people normally prepare in their own home. It's something that you sort of leave the experts to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's people that make their living out of making these confections. But some of these traditions are being lost. So because newer generations are not as interested in producing them, or they have other opportunities. But also a lot of the younger generations are not consuming these artisan products.
Yeah,
but
right.
But it is a very much a tradition held by, you know, by people that specialize in
yeah.
it.
You have a whole section on convent sweets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the history there?
Well, the history of the convents I think is responsible for the majority of the sweets tradition, if I dare to say, in Mexico. Because when the Spaniards arrived, they arrived, you know, a lot of nuns arrived, and they set up a lot of convents. And in these convents, you know, they needed to do certain things to bring money. And one of the things that they did was to educate, you know, young girls from wealthy families. They educated them in different aspects. Mm-hmm. And one of the aspects was cooking.
Yeah.
And also there is some data that they had also some African slaves and Caribbean slaves. So they were all kind of got together in the kitchen, you know, and so a lot of the things. And I also think that it was a way to escape. If you look at even the names of some of the sweets that they have, you know, they have like Kiss of an Angel. They have these little meringues called suspiros, which means sigh. So I almost wonder if it wasn't a way for them to, you know, manifest how they were feeling and just put their passion through through their food.
Yeah.
And then the nuns, you know, would also sell their sweets to try to bring some money, and they became very, very known. So anybody that visits Puebla, the state of Puebla, which mm-hmm. is near Mexico City, it's known for its candies, and it's known for the convents that are responsible for them.
What's the most exciting thing about these foods for you?
Wow, that's a very hard question. But I think that the most exciting thing is sharing a bit of the culture of the sweetness of Mexico. And by the sweetness, I don't only mean the sweet things, but the sweetness of the people. And, you know, just trying to keep a bit of these traditions alive. I think there's something absolutely unique and special that needs to be preserved and appreciated.
Fanny, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fanny Gerson is author of My Sweet Mexico. Now, for a truly unexpected holiday sweet, try her coconut stuffed limes. You can find the recipe and a trove of other holiday ideas on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, if you didn't have your act together enough in maybe August when the peaches were at their peak, begging to be put up in brandy or made into chutney, which would have been the perfect hostess gift this month, never fear, it's not too late. According to Jam mistress Rachel Saunders, winter can be the perfect time for putting up. Rachel, nice to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So tell me, what can we do right now with the citrus and the winter fruits that we've got?
Citrus is incredibly versatile, and actually, I think lemon, which is a fruit that everyone has easy access to, lemon is one of the easiest fruits to work with, and it combines well both with many other citrus fruits, but also other fruits. What's nice about it is that it's very easy to get good results, and it's also very good on its own, as maybe in a marmalade. And then oranges, which are another fruit that everyone has easy access to. There are basically two types of oranges, sweet and sour. Sour being Seville orange is the sort of the most common.
Yeah.
But among the ones that are the most commonly available, Valencia oranges make great marmalade. They have a great flavor, and I like to combine them with cardamom. Especially, I have a kumquat cardamom Valencia orange marmalade that's one of my personal favorites.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, what's nice about Valencia orange marmalade is that it's very beautiful to look at as well as being delicious. Sour oranges tend to get kind of muddy when you're cooking. So aesthetically, Valencias are wonderful. And navels also can be used. They don't have quite as much of a zip to them, their flavor. But they work quite well as well. And basically any warm spices such as cinnamon, cloves, cardamom, ginger, etc., they all go very well with orange.
So you've got that tart, sweet quality of the citrus, and you can play those warm tasting spices against them. And you get.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'm thinking about what a marmalade looks like, and it's the fruit almost shines like jewels.
Yeah. And I find, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I hate marmalade. And, you know, there is such a range of marmalade out there. And, I should rather say, there is such a range of possible marmalades out there, and they don't have to be bitter. And they also just so exquisite. And I think they are among the most satisfying preserves that you can make.
Rachel, what do you do with grapefruit?
Grapefruit is one of the best fruits for marmalade, actually. And
really?
There's a lemon and pink grapefruit recipe in the book, and I have 3 pages of illustration for it because the technique is quite involved, but it gives great results. The grapefruits get blanched multiple times in boiling water to rinse out that extra bitterness that they have.
Yeah.
And then they get sort of scooped. So you end up with thick peel, and then it gets chopped and incorporated into the marmalade. So it is multiple steps, but the results are wonderful. And the lemon and pink grapefruit marmalade is actually one of our best sellers.
Rachel, you've got a recipe, pear jam with rosemary and pine?
Yes. Pears go wonderfully with herbs. And I had this pinecone bud syrup, which I
always have it in the cupboard.
I know. It's one of those things you carry it with you when you travel. Yeah. No, I basically came across it and I thought I have to use this. And so I bought some, and then it took me a while to think of what would it go with. And then I decided it would go well with pear. And it's just wonderful. It's just the perfect accent to pears. And it also adds a little bit of a warm color to the jam.
Ooh.
So it's really lovely.
I'm thinking of how those pine buds smell when you lightly pinch them and they have sap, you know, they're sticky. And that incredible smell, that would be, if that were in jam.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And you need a fruit where that's going to come through enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So something gentle like pears is perfect.
Rachel, thank you for talking with us and for all the temptations.
Oh, you are so welcome. It's so great to be here. Thank you so much.
Rachel Saunders is author of the Blue Chair Jam Cookbook. She left us with recipes for pear jam with rosemary and pine. Doesn't that sound interesting? And for her lemon and pink grapefruit marmalade. Now, you're going to find both on the website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
You and me can talk. The lines are open. Give us a call, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook or send an email, splendidtable.org. We have got Emily calling from Switzerland. Emily, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hello, Lynn. I first would like to say I haven't been listening to the program very long, but since it's come on the air over here in Geneva, I have a new love crush on your show. So Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Now, are you Swiss or are you there for other reasons?
No, I'm born and bred in New Jersey, but have been living over here in Europe, various places in Europe, since 2001 and working over here.
Geneva's such a gorgeous city. I haven't
it
been there
is.
In
it's
years.
It's beautiful. And the snow is starting to creep down the mountains now. So look out the window across the lake and we've got snow-capped mountains. It's a really special, beautiful place to be.
Sounds glorious. Okay, enough of the tourist stuff. Let's get, do you have a question?
I do have a question. I do. I make an annual pilgrimage back to the U.S. every year and try and bring back all sorts of gifts and goodies for the friends back home.
Right.
And I was hoping that you could help me think of some new ideas of things that I can make to cook and bring home, because I think my friends and family overwhelmed with the pots of jams and jellies because nobody eats jams and jellies anymore.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And so, you know, I've been bringing them over and they dutifully open them and have them on like a bagel. And then I find them the next Christmas still sitting in the fridge. Do you have other ideas or suggestions of little Christmas gifts?
And you want things that you can make?
Well, things that I can make are things that, you know, I won't be deported for bringing across the border.
The first thing that comes to my mind, and this is a long shot because the part of Switzerland that I know the best is around the area of Bern. And what I remember is that at this time of year, there was a candy, and maybe it's done where you are too. It looks literally like a chestnut in its shell, and it's in that beautiful green prickly casing that it grows in on the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a small candy. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's done with marzipan and chocolate.
And yes.
Yeah. And you know, giving someone three of those, because I don't think they're inexpensive, it's so unusual. And as I remember, they were delicious. I think I remember them filled with cream and, you know, bittersweet chocolate and nuts or something. But maybe put even one, depending on their size, in just little boxes or little round tins and wrap them. And I think they would travel pretty well. So mm-hmm. That's one thing. The other thing you might want to do, since Switzerland is so famous for chocolate,
mm-hmm.
Why not bring them each a little stack that you tie with a ribbon of all the local chocolate bars? There's probably local makers, you know, that for not a lot of money, you could get a little bar of each one of those chocolates.
Okay.
That, you know, that you can only get where you are right now. And that might be a really nice treat. And, you know, that's the kind of thing. It can be small. It's not hard to pack in the suitcase. It's not going to break.
Excellent.
And by the way, you don't do any work. I mean, if there's something you love to make, and especially if it smacks of something about your experiences of living in Europe, do make it, without a doubt. I remember I could easily get red currants when I was living in Europe, which nobody could normally get in the States very easily. Mm-hmm. And I would just cook them with brandy and some port, and I'd put them in little jars, tiny jars. So that, again, they were easy. And then I would ship them. But the point being that kind of thing can be really, really simple. And it's the sort of thing that, yeah, people might not use it unless you put a label on it. Wonderful with cold turkey.
Okay.
Yeah. No,
and that's perfect. I still have some currants from the summer.
Yeah.
So I could cook those up.
Cook those up. Put them in pretty jars. Little ones. Tie a ribbon. Tell people they can use it with savories. Wonderful if you moisten a piece of bread with it for a sandwich. That is something that's really fabulous with leftover whatever you've had for Christmas.
Right.
So give it a shot.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
And do me a favor. Say hello to Geneva for me.
I will.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take care, Emily.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, for what and where was the first patent issued? Okay, start musing. We're going to be back with the answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a minute, but first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, for what and where was the first patent issued? Well, it was something food-related, and it was 2,500 years ago in Greece. And this comes to us courtesy of Balin Linikin. He was talking about the patent law on the listserv of the Association of the Study of Food and Society. Here's the story. The oldest record of a patent was from Greece, and it gave any cook or caterer who invented an unusual or peculiar dish the monopoly on the dish for 1 year. Now, the purpose was to protect the rights and the possible profits of the creator of a dish, but also to encourage invention. Now, you can't do that today. Of course, you could charge for sharing recipes or do what cooks have done forever, which is share the recipe but leave out a few key ingredients. Anyway, back to your calls.
800-537-5252. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email, splendidtable.org.
Okay, who's up next? We have got Christina calling from Portland, Oregon. Christina, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about white wine.
Okay.
I work for a part-time for a catering company.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we'll have leftover bottles because we open them so that they're ready to pour.
Right, right.
So many times I'll take home 7 or 8 or even almost a case of open bottles. And I have red bottles and I have white bottles. And with the red bottles, I kind of feel comfortable and I know what to do with them. You know, I'll make a red wine syrup or I'll use it to braise some meat.
Right,
but
right.
I'm not sure about what to do with all these bottles of white wine.
Well, first of all, I have to say, you lucky soul.
Yeah.
And you know, anything you can do with a red wine, you can do with a white wine.
Okay.
So the idea would be making a wine syrup out of white wine. It doesn't have quite the same amount of fullness and perhaps tannin, but you still can get a great, you know, syrup out of it. One of the other things that, you know, may be a great idea to do, because you know how wonderful just taking wine and reducing it in a pan after you've cooked something in it, you get this great pan sauce.
Sure.
One way you shortcut that process is you boil down the wine ahead of time so that it's really pretty intense to begin with, and then you just stir it into the pan sauce. Well, what about the idea of taking a whole batch of your white wine that you just can't hold on to? Because it sounds like, especially this time of year, you're going to be inundated. I mean, you're not going to be able to get across the kitchen for the bottles. Why not take a big skillet, pour in, you know, whatever's left from a couple of bottles, and simmer that down until it's reduced by maybe 3/4 or more.
Uh-huh.
And then put it in ice cube trays and freeze it. Pop out the cubes, stick it in the freezer, and keep doing that.
That's a great idea.
And then you can add that to stew. You can add it to the, you know, the proverbial thing, always the same things. You stew, the soup, the pan sauces. But it can go into all of those things.
And I mean, I can use it after the holidays. Awesome.
You can use it for the next year. It's going to keep as long as a lot of air doesn't get to it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, so you've got instant, intense wine flavor. And you could boil down buckets of the stuff. But I use a big 12-inch saute pan for that kind of thing because it just does it really, really fast. And one of the tricks, by the way, is keep scraping down the side of the pan because the wine goes up against the side and it literally starts to caramelize a little bit. You know?
Okay.
Keep scraping that back into the liquid because that is just delicious stuff.
All the flavor.
Yeah,
sounds
exactly.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. So that would probably use up a lot of that wine.
Definitely.
And
well,
you know,
I appreciate it.
You are welcome. And you have a great holiday.
Okay, thank you.
And by the way, don't work too hard. I know what a catering business is like during the holidays.
I can rest in January.
Exactly. There are rest cures, spas, and whatever designed particularly for people in the food business who, in January, desperately need it. Have a good one, Christina.
Okay, thanks, Lynn.
You are welcome. Bye. We've got an email from Benjamin in Pinehurst, North Carolina now. He says he wants ideas for flavorful, sparkly drinks for the holidays. He wants bases that he can mix up and then add alcohol or not as guests choose. Benjamin, this is a great idea. This is what I usually do. I start out with what's called a simple syrup. This is where you take equal parts of water and sugar. And you put them in a saucepan and you heat them until the sugar melts and the syrup is clear. This is going to keep in the fridge for weeks. Now, once you have this simple syrup, you can add things to it like fresh pressed lime juice or lemon juice. And you can take that syrup and you can flavor it. So let me give you an idea of where I'm going with this. If you make a big batch of the simple syrup, and half of it you do in one pan where you add whole allspice, cinnamon sticks, black pepper, some nutmeg. Heat that up. Let it get clear. Let it steep for about a half hour at room temperature and then strain it. Put that in the fridge. Do another batch where you load up the syrup with cut up fresh ginger. Now you have ginger syrup. With those two, you can make a whole variety of drinks. If you take cranberry juice, and I'm talking the real tart stuff, and mix it with the spiced ginger syrup, add some bubbly water, some club soda, This is a dynamite drink on its own over ice, and it's great over ice with a shot of vodka. Take the ginger syrup, mix that with some fresh lemon or lime juice, and you could add rum to that. You could add almost anything alcoholic to that. A bit of gin, throw in some club soda, some slices of the fruit, okay, lime slices, lemon slices. Looks great, tastes so fresh and so bright, and you're off and running. So there's two ideas for you, and you can play with them. We've got Lauren calling from Atlanta. Lauren, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You are welcome.
I wanted to ask you, I'm 24 years old, and I am definitely what I would consider a novice cook.
Okay.
And this year, I would really like to participate in my family's annual holiday potluck party for the very first time. And I wanted to see if you could recommend maybe an appetizer or a dessert that isn't too difficult to execute, but maybe looks like it's harder to make than it actually is.
Oh, let's see now. We've got a lot of possibilities. Let me think. What kinds of things come to the potluck? You know, what's the mood of the potluck?
Well, I would say it's very warm. You know, lots of friends and family.
Right, right. Is it comforting food?
Good people.
You know, comforting food kind of thing. And are people only eating with their fingers, or are they doing, you know, the one fork in the plate kind of thing?
It is some of it. It's usually small plates, you know. Small,
right, right.
Small plates.
Well, you know, there is a dessert that is so dead easy. Okay, so here's the thing: it's for panna cotta. Have you ever had panna cotta?
Yes, my family is Italian, so.
Absolutely. Oh boy! Okay, have I got a panna cotta for you? All right. There's two things you're gonna. Do you have a glass bowl, a clear glass bowl that's kind of pretty?
Yes, I do.
All right. We're going to do a very fancy version of panna cotta. Okay, this is going to serve in small portions, probably 8 to 10 people, and you can increase it. Or you can make like 1.5 recipes. But here's the basic recipe. 3 cups of really nice heavy cream, not the ultra-pasteurized yucky stuff. And you put the cream in a saucepan, like a 4-quart saucepan, okay? You want 1 cup of sour cream in a big bowl. Then you want 1/2 cup of sugar in with the cream in the saucepan, 2 teaspoons of vanilla in with the cream in the saucepan, okay, and a generous pinch of salt. Now, the other thing you're going to do is you're going to take an envelope of gelatin, all right?
Okay.
And you're going to take about 2, well, take the whole envelope. We're going to gel it firm, but that'll make it much easier to serve, all right? So we're going to take the whole envelope of gelatin, and you're going to take just a little cup, like a coffee cup, put about 1/3 of a cup of cold water in there, and sprinkle that gelatin envelope over it, and let it sit for about 5-10 minutes. Put the pan of the cream and the sugar right on the stove over medium heat. Stir it with a spatula, okay, so that it doesn't stick to the bottom, and just get it to the point where it's warm, bordering on hot. You don't want to boil it.
Okay.
By that time, the gelatin is going to have gotten saturated with the water and swollen up. Okay? Dump that in and stir that into the cream and keep stirring off the heat until there's no lumps. And the way you know there's no lumps is you literally stick your immaculately clean 2 fingers in it and you rub it. And you feel no lumps. All right? Let that cool about 5 minutes and then add it with a whisk slowly into that sour cream. Just keep whisking. This is to make sure there are no lumps. All right? You have now made the panna cotta. That's it.
Oh, wow.
Now, you can add other flavorings to it if you want. I mean, you could add some grated ginger. I mean, you could add a little bit of a liqueur that you like. But that's the panna cotta. That's it. It's all done.
That's so simple.
It's so easy. Now, you can just set that aside. Now, the other thing you can do is we're going to make a tiered layer. You're going to take red wine. So you're going to take about 3 cups of red wine and about 1/2 cup of sugar and some more vanilla and some spices like cinnamon and allspice. And if you can do it with whole cinnamon and whole allspice, it'll be really dynamite. Okay. And you're going to boil that in a skillet for about 3 minutes. Taste it. Cool it first a little bit, right? To see if it's sweet enough. And then you're going to do the same thing with another envelope of gelatin that you did with the other thing. In something where it's soak it. stir that in. Let those both cool down to room temperature. And then the first thing that you do is make a little layer of the panna cotta in the bottom of your bowl and stick it in the fridge. Now, you could start this 3 days ahead because it can wait forever. Let that chill. Now, room temperature wine gel, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let that chill until it's firm. Keep building layers. End up with a wine gel layer. Then what you sprinkle on there are perhaps things like little bits of colored sugar, you know, or those little silver balls that are so pretty that go on cookie.
Oh, those are beautiful.
They're gorgeous. Yeah. And you've got the most spectacular looking dessert. And it's terribly Italian. And everybody just scoops up whatever they want.
Oh, my gosh. This is going to be
a
hit.
And it's going to be great fun. And all you have to do is let each layer gel completely. You know, chill. And don't worry because, you know, you'll be fine.
That's wonderful. Well, I can't wait. They're going to be so shocked.
They're going to be so impressed.
I can't wait. This is going to be just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Lauren, you have a great holiday and a great
potluck. Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Now, look, the panna cotta itself, minus that wine gel, is so dead easy. You can make it in 5 minutes. I can't tell you how simple it is. Now, the recipe is on the website, splendidtable.org. We've got Cindy on the line from Bardstown, Kentucky. Cindy, I think I remember a great ham I had years ago that came from Bardstown, but you no doubt had a question. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about pecans.
Yeah.
This year for the holidays, I dehydrated some herbs from the garden and did a scented sugar. And then I collected from our old pecan tree out front 66 pounds of pecans.
Oh, my. Well, how big is this tree?
It is over 100 feet and about 5 feet diameter.
Whoa.
It's huge. And if it's, you know, when they're falling, they thunk you on the head sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ooh. So I want to be able to send them so it's not local. And I'm looking for kind of savory ways, you know, gift ideas.
How about roasting them with some of those herbs? One of the classic things you can do with nuts is kind of give them a Mediterranean take of tossing them with a little bit, very small amount of olive oil and then coarse salt, black pepper, and a very generous amount of those herbs, and then roast them at about 300 degrees and give them maybe 10, 15 minutes until they're toasty. And you want to be really generous. Don't overdo the salt, but you really want to be generous with those herbs because they fade. And it could be fabulous. You could even throw a little bit of paprika or hot chili. And you could do different flavorings, like you could do thyme and lemon zest. And then you could do basil and garlic and maybe even sprinkling them with a little bit of balsamic vinegar and the salt. And then you do a slow roast on those.
Oh, okay. With the garlic, should I use powdered or fresh?
No, don't use powder. Use fresh garlic, but be careful. Keep the oven low because garlic can burn.
Okay.
If you have any doubts, add the garlic for the last 5 minutes of roasting.
Oh, okay.
But usually a nut's going to roast in 10 minutes, depending on how fresh they are, how much oil there is in it. But that's a direction you can go in, and it should really be dynamite, and it's going to make good gifts.
Wonderful. Well, I also love, like, toasted nut oils to make, like, salad dressings.
Don't go that route.
No, don't.
No, seriously. You don't want to put the nuts in oil.
Well,
you could crush them and make oil. I've never tried that. No, my concern was that you wanted to put the nuts under oil. That can be dangerous. But if you want to press them and see if you get oil, why not?
I end up with a lot of pecan butter, probably.
Well, yeah, and pecan butter is not a bad thing, by the way.
Yeah, no.
And that's something else to think about. Think about spiced pecan butter.
Oh,
you know, wouldn't that be nice? Kind of a chili pecan butter. That would really be fabulous.
I'm excited. Ready to go crack some more and
go,
get started.
Hey, get to work. You've got all those nuts to work with.
All right.
Hey, Cindy, thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
You take care, girl.
You too.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week.
Thanks for joining us. And remember, you know how to reach us anytime. 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this simple thought. May it be a season of joy, good friends, and good times. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Check out our series of special podcasts called How to Eat Weekends, based on our new book of the same name, as well as our new blog. And you can find it all here, well, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear with help from Chris Holacek. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.